Okay.
The Shallow Rock River that divides Iran and Iraq is the only way to get to the major seaport of those countries. Therefore, there's a debate about who owns the river. The Iranians say the river must be available to both of us. The Iraqis say, well, the boundary's drawn over on your side of the river, so the river's ours. So they've been fussing about that for years. But then as you get on far north, the boundary is very ill-defined, a mountainous, well-wooded area. And there was no debate. No one cared until they started drilling oil wells up in there. No one cares who drills a well or where they drill it until one comes in with oil. And as soon as one country discovers oil, the other country says, oh, but you're on our side. So there's a debate there. Plus, they have the Kurds up in there. And it's an ethnic group that spills over into Iraq, Iran, and Turkey. And the Kurds are an indiscriminate type of people that just lay the hell on everybody's house. And we don't want anybody to tell us what to do, because it's pretty hard to get along. So whether you believe it or not. So there's always a debate along the Iraqi border. Over on the other side, they have the Baluchis. The Baluchis extend over in the eastern part of Iran, western Pakistan, southern Afghanistan. And the communist world has been publishing for over 50 years, little pamphlets and papers saying there should be a separate nation called Baluchistan. And if the communists get control of what they claim the territory of Baluchistan should be, that means they have a warm water port that they've been looking for to the open city for many years. The Shah, his personal evaluation is that I've got to be prepared to fight my neighbors if I have to. I don't want to, but if I have to, all right. Then when he looks to the north, to Russia, he's very upset because the great port of Baku, up on the Caspian Sea, used to be Persian territory. But about 150 years ago, I think it was, the Russians just decided, well, we want a little more territory. And they came down the western and the eastern shore of the Caspian Sea, the chain of 100 or more miles, and just by military force took it away from the Iranians. So the Iranians don't trust the Russians. And then after World War II, when they had the Big Three meeting, and the decision was made to withdraw from Iran, Russia says, you're not going to get out. So they stayed up around Tabriz and up in that part of the country for a long, long time until 1947, when President Truman said, we've got the atomic bomb and you don't get out. The Russian thing was true. So the Iranians feel very beholden to the United States for having, quote, kicked the Russians out. But they don't trust the Russians at all, and that came up time and time and time again. We talk all the afternoon on their distrust of the Russians. But he felt that he had to have an armed force that was strong, and to answer your question, President Nixon apparently, and Kissinger apparently agreed with him.
I've read that in accounts, I read an account of the meeting between Nixon and the Shah, that it was allegedly Nixon asked the Shah to protect me, to protect American interests in the Persian Gulf region. So the words protected were apparently used. Did you hear anything to that extent, in that way?
I never heard it expressed in those lines. But there was never even the slightest question of what we, as the United States, were depending on Iran to be the major stability factor in that part of the world, down into the Indian Ocean to about the 10th parallel. Based on that, we agreed to sell him T-5 reconnaissance airplanes, these big planes would go up and stay for hours and hours and hours in patrol to see when they can fly. We agreed to sell him a good many things that would allow him to project more than just internal defense for the country of Iraq. Yes, we were dependent on him. When you say protect our interest, it might be a little bit of an overstatement. To be a major factor in our stabilizing that part of the world. No question.
You said a little bit about the, there are a lot of anecdotes that you've recalled about this visit. Can you relate some of them?
I don't think it seems very striking or interesting.
I don't know if they would be of any interest from the standpoint of historical importance. As I recall, there were about 30 or more large cargo type planes sending supplies and equipment and all that to support almost a momentary freedom move. When the arrangements were being made, the Iranians wanted the Shah and the President to drive from the airport through the city and up to the palace in a regal chariot, horse-drawn chariot, and our people objected to that, saying that they couldn't give them adequate security. And I thought it got the Iranian nose out of joint, because they really honestly believe security is no problem. And our security people were swarmed all over the place, and the Iranian walkway would, I think, is enough to do, but they didn't feel at that time that there was a security problem. The Iranians set up a state dinner at the palace where everyone was expected to have on tuxedos. And we got a message back from the United States that logistically infeasible for them to bring a formal attire. And our ambassador sent a message, I don't have the heart to send this message to the Iranians. Please come off of that. Bring your tuxedos with you, which they did. They gave it and all that one. Our ambassador just turned purple. Sending all these cargo planes with all these heavy loads, and they say they can't afford to bring tuxedos. It doesn't make sense. There was one little thing that our State Department didn't want me to attend. When the formalities began, you know, things of that sort, it's always appropriate for them to have toast to this, toast to that, and next day, my Air Force said, can't understand what the people are doing. He said, the television cameras had you all displayed out there, and everything looks so beautiful. And then all of a sudden, they show us the chandelier. They said, we got the cotton picking tired of looking at chandeliers. We couldn't understand. He said, everything was going fine, and then all of a sudden, the cameras were looking at the chandeliers. And I said, don't you realize that? At that time, we were drinking toast, and they didn't want to offend the Muslim religious people because they don't drink. we said the Baptists don't stand, too. But every time they start drinking toast, the camera ball will lift it to the ceiling.
That's all I can recall right now. But there were, I'm sure, trying to make several of those. But, one thing. My wife and Dr. Kissinger were partners at the thing. And then the president got up to talk. As it turned out, the light was going right in his face. And his notes were right down there. He couldn't see them. He couldn't read them at all. So he just gave a little extemporaneous conversational type thing, went over very nicely, was very sincere and all that. But Dr. Kissinger and the Margaret, he said, we worked for hours and hours writing that speech for him, and he hasn't used a single word of it yet.
Getting back to the hold of the arms sales question again. I guess up through 71 or so, the U.S. had a called an annual review. Whereby Iranian weapons requests the U.S. to be sort of vetted by the embassy and the MAG. Were you involved in that at all?
In the military assistance program. I think the quarterly reviews. But then the biggie comes as the annual review to get ready for the congressional presentations, where we have to tell the Congress, this is what we've done and this is what we want to do next year. That comes at about the half-year approach. In other words, when one year is about 6 months old, we go to the Congress and say, we plan to finish out the year doing this, and then this is what we want to do. Well, that's probably what you refer to.
Like, a lot of people called me interviews, the U.S. had some kind of a vetting law which would determine what would be sold and what would not be sold to Iran. It would have been involved for U.S. intervention in terms of what the Shah could buy every year. This is just started in the mid-60s, the early 70s.
That would have been very appropriate in the 60s, when we were still partially, at least, in the Grant Aid business. See, immediately after the war, in the 50s, most everything was grant. And then it was picking up a little bit. We started off, and this was, I was on a special study group to get this thing started in 1954, 1956. But we looked at every country we could to see how we could reduce the U.S. taxpayers' expenses. And in a vast majority of the countries where we were having the grant aid program, we had an agreement that we won't give you anything that you can't support or won't support. In other words, if we give you this truck, you then have to, out of your pocket, buy all the spare parts for it, and buy all the gasoline and the replacement tires. In other words, you have to support the grant and the aid end items, as we call them. An end item is a gun or a tank or a an airplane or something of that sort. So they had to support the grant items. That's the way it started. And as it went on, we said, in effect, as the country went on developed, we said, okay, you need 100 of these. We'll give you 50 if you buy 50. You pay full price for 50 of them, we'll give you 50 more. So we were cutting back. You know, the grant aid, the Marshall Plan, was a big deal in the late 40s and early 50s, both in military and in economic support. So we were coming along in the late 50s and 60s, paring that down as best we could. So that's the review type thing, and that went on every
every 3 months, and then a real wash spring out every year.
I guess in terms of Randall, in the late 60s, and maybe into the late early 70s, would also include items that would be purchased under credits, like FMS credits, or export import credits, but it's going to be credit allocation, so it would be given to the Iranians, under which they would make their purchases of American weapons systems and so forth. I guess the NWU included that as well.
Yes, it did include that, but actually the military didn't get into that. The Iranians were, by the time I got over there, were handling everything. Hanover Manufacturers Bank, for instance.
That's private credit.
And that's private credit. They were handling the major portion of the private credit. So we didn't get involved in that. Now, there may have been something that could be going on back in that day. In effect, we had been told that the Iranians can afford this. It's up to the Iranians to figure this out. And several times, I worked with General Clinton, kind of did all the purchasing before he came to the States. But he made trips to the States several times just to work out the financial business.
You mentioned at the May 22nd meeting with Sean, he said that he could buy anything he wanted for nuclear weapons. Did you believe at that time the Iranian armed forces could use anything that it bought?
No, not for anything. And I worked very, very closely with all three of the services. And the commander of the Imperial Staff, as he was called, he was actually a combination of what we have over here, the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Staff, commander of the Imperial Staff. Our offices were side by side. We worked very closely, almost on a daily basis. I went in and discussed it with the procurement manager and discussed it with the shop quite frequently. And my one main point was capable, trained people in the right numbers at the right time. I must have repeated that dozens and dozens and dozens of times. Saying, don't buy that until you can use it properly. We went through that time and time again. I'll tell you a couple of answers on that, but I think proved my point. We were involved one time in the initial phases of the helicopter building. And I saw the end of the shot. I told him he was going too fast, he didn't have the horses to make it run. But you can't run this race until you get a lot more than just power. I said, you're not talking about just power. We're talking about maintenance people, engine experts, airframe experts, radio repairmen, administrative people. I said, you're talking about a lot of technicians that you need on a hurry-up basis. But you can't hurry up so much so that all this stuff will come in and just inundate you with physical things that you can't use. So, the next day I got a little notice that 57 minutes that the entire graduating class from the universities was being inducted into the Navy. This was the Navy helicopter gallery, Navy building gallery. And then another time on the aviation, we decided to take in fact, and I finally said, well, you don't need college graduates. You need people with the mentality. who become college graduates if they go to school long enough. But there are a lot of technician-type jobs that if you take a high school graduate and give him the proper education, proper training, technical training, he will probably make you a more satisfied serviceman. See, they had the national service requirements over there, so everybody had to get 2 years to come. I said, if you take a man with a college degree or an advanced degree, take him in the service and make him a radio mechanic, you have a dissatisfied customer right from the beginning. You'll never be happy. But if you take a high school graduate that's got to go afford to go to college, and you give him that skill, I said, you'll probably make you a good military man. And if he doesn't make the, doesn't stay in the military, he'll make a good technician out in the civilian world. So I said, you don't need all of these college graduates right away. You'll be doing your country a disservice. But you do need a lot of people on a time schedule. Well, let's do a little work at it. The next day I got a call from the chief of imperial staff. We're having a meeting this afternoon. And we want you to attend. So I went in, and there was General Authority, the top man, in the Academy of the Air Force, the commander of the Army, Captain Natal, the commander of the Navy. Oh, even had the whole beta there, the Prime Minister. Had the whole, oh, must be 25 beta there. They had top people in the country. They had set up a commission to prove me wrong. And they announced, General Williamson has told His Imperial Majesty that we don't have the numbers of trainable people available on the front time schedule. So our job is to figure out a way to get them. So I said, gentlemen, if you can prove me wrong, I'll be the happiest person in this room. I'd be delighted to be wrong. But it just appears to me that if you take every available mentally capable person and cram him into the envelope, you're going to give your country a great deal of security. I said, that's too fast for me. So that was one of our jobs, to kind of temper the thing and not let it move this fast. It still moved faster than they wanted to. In their discussion, in their discussion about how we're going to get people, I told you they had national service. Everybody came in and had to either come in the armed forces for 2 years or be in the literacy corps, which is a high school teaching thing. They would take a high school graduate, attend school, 6 months to learn how to teach English for us, and then put it out in the tribes. And soon after, they go back to the tribes that they come from and teach. They got a literacy program back then. They had another good one in sanitation, teaching just basic sanitation, just how to get the surface water out of your drinking water, things of that sort. They were doing a lot with their national service. But, the way it worked, if a guy was a draftee, he came in for 2 years service at the lowest possible level and stayed there. He didn't advance during his 2 years. He learned a limited skill and he functioned. He did that thing, whatever it was, for 2 years. If a guy decided that he wanted to enlist and be a regular, he enlisted for what? He didn't enlist for 20 years or 30 years. He enlisted for life. Came in and the stipulation was, you will be trained to the maximum level of your mental capacities. We will take you just as far as you can go in good many different fields. And when you finish your schooling, you are a non-commissioned officer. They never served as private. They became non-commissioned officers from the first day after their schooling. So they had these 2 years, lifetime. So the Iran
on and start talking about it, we're going to get all these people and go down the river from wrong. We've got to have a short-term enlistment. So they came up with a good idea of a short-term enlistment. And I kept asking them, what do you mean? Their short-term was 11 years. So their attitude toward the military was simply different from ours here in this country. And just to give you an example, my driver, my sedan driver, was a sergeant. And he won the national lottery. And here's a man with a high school education. He wasn't in real great shape, so I'm a pretty individual finding. He was a good driver, dependable driver, always dependable. But he won the national lottery, which all of a sudden gave him $5 million. So I asked him, all of a sudden you've got all that. What are you going to do? He said, well, I'm going to buy my parents a farm. My father has always wanted to own his own land. He ended up buying a farm. I'm going to take this Mercedes up to him and trade it in on a Take-On, which is a little locally made car. He says, man, my statue just has no business driving around. You say, it would embarrass me. And one of my friends said, I'm going to buy Take-On. Take-On. And then I'm going to buy a house in a different part of town. I have two little children, and I want to buy a house close to a good school. I said, and then what are you going to do? He says, I signed up for life. He said, I'm in the Army for life. And I gave him my word. He had no thought of leaving the service. He had given him his word, he'd stay for life. And just to face on, I said, well, if you were released of that obligation, what would you like to do? He said, I would love to go home and farm with my father. But I'm not really taking this job. They had it was a different viewpoint. But 11 years was there, short time. And after weeks and months of discussion, I think I finally won. Got them all to accept the fact that training personnel and right numbers should be the pacing factor of their expansion. Before that, their pacing factor is how quick they can produce and make it work. And they were, just before I came over there, they bought a bunch of C-130 airplanes. But they literally intended looking at the start because they couldn't get the head machines on the same stage as the village did. We worked out a wonderful deal on that one. I was doing a lot of these back here and worked very closely with them. They had, like you gave them a space, I think about 37 persons in their minds. Lockheed had that says, if you buy this many, I can give them to you. That's great. If you do right, so Iran, you will get financially a real good deal on the price of the airplane. But the delivery schedule is so much faster. You would have cost them several $1 million, just a warehouse. But as it went on, I worked here for a couple of years. Producer here in the United States found sales for them in other foreign countries about as fast as they could make them. So every time they could sell one down Latin America, for instance, that would delay the delivery of them line in line a little bit. But that kept going on, and I don't believe they ever put a single airplane in store. I believe my 100 foot still 30 years ago.
I guess I gather during the mid-70s there was a big concern in Washington about whether Iran had a sort of the absorptive capacity to use all the weapons that they were buying, and whether the infrastructure was enough, was adequate.
The highways was not adequate at all.
Yeah.
For instance, the Army Aviation Program, I mentioned that several times, because that was by far the biggest one that required training people. You can take a big airplane, say you spend $30 million on airplanes, you don't get many airplanes. And you don't require many technicians. But you spent $30 million on helicopters. You could fly a helicopter and guide a lot of technicians. Well, facilities and things like that. So the pacing factor was really terrific. The ability to keep up just wasn't there in the Army Aviation Program. They couldn't go near as fast as the Shah wanted. So they took over a complete Air Force base in Escalon. The Air Force was built out the whole airfield and all the hangars and this, that, and the other. And we got up a little team and sent them to the 7 different space bases here in the United States where we were doing this. In other words, Fort Rucker, Alabama was our pilot training base. Fort Eustis was that's our transportation people. Dayton, Ohio was another one. They have them. We had 7 major aviation, Army aviation activities going on. So this team went to each of those bases. Now, the team was made up of U.S. personnel. Went to these bases and selected the beautiful activity or the most vital activity that this base had, that that one had, that this man. And then they spent about 3 months drawing up a fantastic master plan of how we could consolidate those best features into Esfahan. Came over and my staff and I worked and did really good, I think. The Iran staff worked and worked. And we took it up to the town, showed it to his majesty, and he made a major change in it, but he says, okay, it's approved. And some of the things he did to get started, there was one big 22-story hotel, just in there. Hadn't got really long about it. He gave it to them. He said, you take this hotel, and that can start off as part of your requirement. If I recall, it was $150 million, some large figure. He said, you have a line of credit. Start your construction, and when you need more, let me know. The Americans were just absolutely ecstatic. A lot of our people that had worked for years at Fort Rucker, for instance, and said, I wish we had this, I wish we had it. All they had to do was say, you ought to have it. And they wanted to say, no. So it turned out, it to this day, it is a fantastic facility. We don't have anything in the United States compared to it. It's beautiful. But he pushed it, and the people on the side factor, their technical skill was up in the breeze. When I first got there, I was the commandant of the school, and he had all these courses available, and this course wasn't filled, and that one wasn't filled. And in a very short time, he was screaming for help because all of his classes were just overloaded. But they went to work.
Talking about the major issue that the Vice President Nixon and Henry Kissinger talked about in the military, implications of the meeting. Were there any other aspects of the meeting, between them and the Shaw, that are worth mentioning, or that you know about, or recall?
I was privileged only with the discussion of the military aspect. I am confident that they talked about a lot of things that were not mentioned to me.
But by the Shaw, or?
As I said, though, I personally sat there and heard President Nixon discuss the bill. I heard Kissinger discuss the bill. And then the following day, I sat down with the Shah, and he discussed the bill. And the three seemed to be right together on their understanding of what had happened. The chances are very great that Dr. Kissinger and the President discussed a lot with the ambassador when I was not there. I was not there. None of my business. No requirement.
Right. And for example, I read that one of the things that was discussed was a question of special aid to the Kurdish insurgency in Iraq. That was probably brought up in the meeting.
If it was, I don't
know. Yeah, right, right. Okay.
But that Kurdish problem was really dirty because several times while I was over there, once right in the middle of the winter, the Iraqis just gathered up thousands of them and drove them down the road. Just they get the hell out of Iraq. And Iran set up warning against along the side of the highway. And just thousands of them. And then the Iraqis would just say, get out. We don't want you. Kurds would move. Come over and they'd be taken care of by the Turkish or the Iranian people, mostly Kurds, and I'd get absorbed and go away in time. But it was just a heartless thing to see people driven down, and I saw this on the road. See people just driven down the road just like sheep.
What do you recall that was across the road?
In the winter time, so it must have been the, I'm not sure whether it was 71 or 72 right now.
Now, when you were stationed in Iran, were you in touch with Pentagon officials who worked on Iranian issues? Who were some of the people that you worked with, who were involved with, who were stationed at the Pentagon?
Secretary of Defense, they had a Admiral P-E-S-H. They had Admiral Pete P-E-S-H. Army had a civilian individual with defensive sales agent, Mr. Olney,
David Olney?
That's not his name, though. I call him Dave because he read Henry David Thoreau so much. I don't recall what his name. Never called him anything but Dave. You know it. No, I didn't know.
He was at the Army staff.
He was Army staff,
yeah.
They had a he could have been Army or Secretary of Defense.
Did they, these people visit Iran from time to time? Or?
Air Force deputy over there, commander, that from the Air Force standpoint. And my brain was gone. Down in Little Beach, South Carolina, man. I'll think I'll pull those.
How much interest did Secretary of Defense Laird have in Iran? Have in Iran? Is he,
During the time that I was over there, the only contacts or knowledge I had was his specific work in regard to that. His name was used quite frequently. That Secretary Laird has decided this, whether his name is used as an office or an individual, I just don't know. But the few times in Turkey I talked to him, he seemed to be quite knowledgeable. Very interested. In time or two, I thought he was very supportive. I say that by the time we had cut the Iranian request for personnel for 3,000 down to 1,000, because 600, I figured he would have got a gun in my throat on that. So I, in my own mind, I kind of accused him of not being supportive as I wished he had. But officially, I think he did a good job for it.
Did he make any visits to Iran while you were there? Were you in touch with officials from other agencies in Washington besides the Pentagon? Or was it mostly just Pentagon contacts that you focused on?
Oh, a fair number of State Department people came over interested in Iran, not specifically the military part, but the military part was a part of it. So, Bill Sisko came over, Bill Sullivan, and a good many top-level people came to visit with Senator Scoop Jackson, came in, several congressional committees.
Briefed them on our sales issues.
Yeah, well, we fought with respect to Senator Jackson. He didn't want to see me. He was passing through. He was, I think at that time, he went just before. He was just coming in and going on down. He didn't want to talk with me at all. And our ambassador just insisted that come in and talk with me. My activity was really one of the pacing factors as to how well we got along with Iran. He could see the schedule was so busy. Our ambassador was so insistent that he said, all right, I'll have breakfast with you. I went down to the hotel at 7 o'clock in the morning. I sat down and had breakfast with him. We talked a little bit, and he was obviously, I knew that he didn't want to talk with me, so I wasn't. I didn't think that I needed either, so I wasn't trying to sell him a bill of goods at all. I was being nice, because I'm about to wonder. During the conversation, I said, you know, you're from the state of Washington, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
I said, I signed an interesting contract just the day before yesterday. Your state? He says, oh, you did? How about Boeing? How much? $360 million. He dropped his fork on his plate. He just literally turned his fork loose and he said, what do you think? I said, oh, yes, sir. These are these long range aerial surveillance things. I said, yes, but this kind of contract with Boeing, $360 million. He said, my plane's leaving at 8 o'clock. I'm going down to Saudi Arabia, but I'll be back tonight. I'm going to see you. he got very, very interested.
Took a new life.
He said, you can't imagine. He says, I worked for years trying to get $10 million contracts in $360 million, and nobody even told me about it. So we did have a good many people come through. Good many of them were surprised on that, what they found that. Just Ron Conley came in one time.
Is that the Treasury Secretary?
Yes, yes. And he came in on Friday. We exchanged telegrams several times on arrival. I asked him if he'd be willing to speak with the press, and he said sure. So he set up the pavilion there. He did hear. Stood up there at the mic and fielded that question. Over, he was talking to my wife. He said, you know, that was a pretty good press turnout. I never expected anyone to like that many. And she said, yes, it was a very nice turnout considering it's the Sabbath. And he looked at me and said, what do you mean? And then all of a sudden his face just lied. He said, your husband sent me a telegram telling me that Friday was the Sabbath, and I...